It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Sarah Nix, in for Anne Strainchamps. Today we're talking about the power of play. We'll take a look at a unique playground where kids run free. They can light bonfires, use rusty old tools, and roll in the dirt. And one man shares the story of how he finally connected with his autistic son by pretending to be Disney characters. How did you play when you were a kid? Was it tag in the park with your friends? Maybe hide and seek in the backyard with your brothers and sisters? It may just seem like fun and games, but some researchers are finding that play is also really important training for adult life. Psychologist Peter Gray writes about play in his book, Free to Learn. Anne Strainchamps talked with him about how play's changed in recent years.
Peter, do you really think that kids today are playing less than previous generations of kids did?
Yes, there's no doubt they are definitely playing less than previous generations. I should probably, to make my answer clear, say something about what play is. When I say playing less, I mean that there is less of what other people might call free play. But to me, free play is play. They're playing less on their own. They're playing less in ways where they are controlling and directing the play, where they're making their own choices, solving their own problems, where they, not adults, are determining from moment to moment what they're doing.
So I take it Little League, youth soccer leagues, karate classes, these, you don't count these as play?
These are not play by this definition. And you know, I can elaborate on this, but there's a dramatic difference in what children learn in those kinds of adult-directed sports and activities compared to the activities that they choose and direct themselves.
Like what? What's the difference in what kids learn?
Well, the big difference is this, that when you are playing, when you are in control of your activities, when you must make the decisions, you learn how to do all those things. You learn how to make decisions. You learn how to control your own behavior because there's no adult controlling it. You learn how to get along with your peers as equals because there's no adult solving your problems. You, as a child, are innately motivated to want to play with other kids. So a natural punishment, if you will, for bullying or for not paying attention to what the other kids want and need is that they won't play with you. And that's how children learn. Well, wait a minute, I've got to pay attention to this other person's needs.
It's interesting because there's been a lot written over the years about the importance of play for very young children, preschool kids, for instance, the importance of imaginative play, art play, sensory play. But we don't talk that much about play for older kids when you get to school age, junior high, high school.
That's exactly right. And I think that's because of certain cultural blinders we have. You know, I've seen developmental psychology textbooks where the early years up to about age 4 or 5 are called the play years. And then you begin to use other terms to talk about children as they get older. We have this concept that children play until they start school. You don't have to go very far back in even our history, even the history that I've lived, to see that, in fact, children continue to play right on through their teenage years. Adults play if they have the opportunity. But when people are free to play, and they continue learning through play.
Hmm. There's an example in your book that I haven't been able to get out of my mind that I wanted to ask you about. You tell the story about how children played during the Holocaust in concentration camps. It's kind of remarkable and also really illustrates that point we were getting at about the difference between how kids want to play and what parents think play is or should be.
There are two morals of that story. This comes from a book by George Emblin that I was referring to called Children and Play in the Holocaust. And he did studies of diaries and interviews of Holocaust concentration camp survivors. And the remarkable thing he discovered is that even under those horrid conditions, children who were physically strong enough to play, played. And they played not at games designed to escape their horrid conditions, but designed to deal with their horrid conditions. They played at things like crematorium, where they would throw rocks and scream like the screams they heard in the distance, and so on. They played at games that allowed them to understand and embrace and somehow deal emotionally and physically with the horrid situation in which they are in. And so what this shows, first of all, is play is such a strong drive that you do it even when you're hungry, even when you're physically weak. It's such a strong drive in children, such a strong need. And secondly, that play for children is not an escape from the real world. It's a way of dealing with the real world. That's really what play is about. Play is children's incorporating into a kind of fantasy world the realities that are around them. And in the fantasy world, they can deal with these realities and they can practice dealing with these realities so that they can deal better with them in the real world.
And what are the consequences for kids themselves? I mean, if young people today have less and less time to devote to free play, are we seeing any results?
I think we're seeing very serious consequences of it. So let me describe what I've found looking historically. So over the last 50 to 60 years, we have seen a continuous decline in children's freedom to play. Over this same period of time, we've seen a continuous, gradual, but ultimately dramatic increase in all sorts of mental disorders in children and young adults. It's not just that we are identifying disorders that we didn't know to look for before, or that we've changed the definition of disorders. Even by standard clinical questionnaires that have been given in unchanged form to normative samples of children, teenagers, and young adults over the years, there is a dramatic increase in anxiety disorders, in major depression. Major depression and anxiety disorders, by today's criteria, are now 5 to 8 times more prevalent among young people than they were in the 1950s. And this change has been gradual. Suicide rate is 4 times now what it was in the 1950s for children under age 15. And something like 2.5 times what it was then for young people between age 15 and 24.
I'm curious, what makes you think that those higher rates of anxiety and depression are because of how we treat children in schools versus, I don't know, more stress at home, economic stress to career or working couples?
This is a good question. So what I've described is a correlation. There's been a continuous decline in play and a continuous increase in all kinds of mental disorders. So there's no relationship between this change in mental disorders and economic stress. Children are far more depressed today than they were during the Great Depression. Adults are far less depressed today than they were during the Great Depression. Children are far more anxious today than they were during the Cold War. You know, I remember the days when we were continuously being warned that the Russians were going to bomb us anytime, and we were protecting ourselves, crawling under our desks, and so on and so forth. You know, but children are affected by their real immediate lives and primarily by their friends. We overemphasize how much children are affected by their parents. I don't want to negate the value of parents. Of course, good enough parenting is important. But ask any child, and what is the child's concern, assuming the parents are good enough? The child's primary concern is friends, getting along with other kids, playing with other kids, having control over his or her life. There's every reason to believe that the lack of that is going to cause anxiety and depression. The lack of the opportunity to learn how to control your own life and feel you're in control results in what is called an external sense of control rather than an internal sense of control, a feeling that you are a victim of fate. And there's a standardized questionnaire for that. And over time period, young people have increasingly felt that they are increasingly victims of the world around them and have less and less responded to this questionnaire in a way indicating that they're in control of their life. We know from clinical research that people who don't have this internal sense of control are prone for anxiety and depression.
Peter, you've painted this kind of chilling portrait of a generation of play-starved, anxious, depressed children. What's going to happen when they become adults? What does a generation of play-starved adults look like?
That's a really interesting question. And I think to some degree, we're beginning to see that a little bit. You know, we're beginning to see anxiety. We're beginning to see among adults less hobbies, less looking for fun in family life, and I think less joy, more of a materialistic approach to the world, less of a search for meaning and finding value. I mean, play is all about meaning in a way. It's all about what is it that I really want to do? You know, the child playing is creating the world as he or she wants it to be, rather than simply adjusting to the world as it is. And so the adults who don't grow up playing don't approach the world with the sense, I want to change the world to be the kind of place I want it to be. They grow up with this more anxious sense of, oh, this is the scary world here. How do I adapt to it?
Peter Gray is a professor at Boston College. His book is Free to Learn. Let's say you wanted to design a perfect playground for kids. What would it look like? We turn to some experts for an answer. They're third graders from Madison's Marquette Elementary.
My name is Tess McGlenn, and I go to Marquette Elementary School. I think it would have a bunch of floors, like 10 floors. And like there would be a slide on the top floor, and then you could go down it, and it was swirly, so it went around the whole playground. So that's how you would do tours. And I think it'd be pretty cool to have a water slide, even if it's a playground, but it's kind of impossible. There could be like a grassy area, and there would be padding under it, so it would be fake grass and padding, and you could do like cartwheels, and there would be like picnic tables, so you could eat your lunch if you wanted to have a picnic.
My name is Ava Davenport, and I go to Marquette. I would probably have a lot of tire swings and a lot of normal swings. And then there would be a lot of monkey bars that went like from the top of the playground to like the bottom of it. There could be like trampolines that you could like jump on if you fell. Maybe places you could like climb up on like nets and then do like a flip down.
I'm Odin Monroe Kane, and I go to Marquette. Well, it'll be really, really big. It'll take like a whole football field. Like, you could go on the bottom of it, little tunnels. Like, you get from one place to another. And it'll be made out of candy. And there'll be just thing of monkey bars where, like, the monkey bars would be, like, all sticky, so it'd be really hard to go. And if you did it, you get, like, some prize. There would be, like, a water fountain, except it, like, had soda instead of a water fountain. Like, instead of healthy snacks, like, candy and stuff would come out.
That was Tess McGlenn, Ava Davenport, and Odin Monroe Kane. They all just finished third grade at Marquette Elementary in Madison. Do you have ideas about the perfect playground? Whether it's for kids or grown-ups, drop us a note on our Facebook page. Coming up, we take a look at one park that's been called the strangest playground on Earth. I'm Sarah Nix, in for Ann Strangechamps, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Sarah Nix, in for Ann Strangechamps. In a small town in northern Wales, there's a wild kind of playground, where it's normal to see mud-covered kids playing with rusty tools or crowded around a bonfire, all without much adult supervision. People call it the land, and it's one of a handful of adventure playgrounds where kids are free to be kids. Claire Griffiths manages the land. I asked her what it looks like.
The playground is possibly not the most aesthetically pleasing, but it exists to please children, not adults. So on the land, you'll find items which range from a wooden pallet to a tiny toy rabbit to something you'd have to really explore in to find.
Describe, if you would, what it's like when a kid who's never been to the land before comes there to play.
When children walk onto the land, they get it. I believe that, you know, they're like programmed to play in a certain way. And a child will walk onto the land and you can see that there's excitement. They're inquisitive and they're curious and they'll explore.
And so what are some of the things that the kids build, say, out of all the loose tumble of equipment there?
They build hotels, they build little dens, what they can call their own. It's very personal, it's very subjective. And often it's not about the end product, it's the process that's important to the children. They could spend all day constructing a den and then knock it down.
Hmm. Yeah, I've seen these videos of the children, you know, using hammers and saws and things like that in a completely unstructured kind of way to build whatever they like.
Yeah, children do use tools. We've got hammers, nails, saws. You know, they're capable and they're competent of doing that. They just need the opportunity.
And as part of the destruction cycle, too, they're allowed to build fires, right?
Yeah, we let children play with fire. And I think it's an element that some adults struggle with, and I get that, but the majority of children are fascinated by it. And hopefully, by providing that opportunity to interact with fire, we're actually enabling them to gain a greater understanding and also respect for fire. You know, a burnt finger now may prevent a more serious accident in later life. Hmm. But when we let children play with fire, it's not straight in, you know, it's graduated access till eventually they're controlling that fire. And, you know, I've seen children come on this journey and gain so much confidence, self-esteem, and also social status, you know.
And you do have these people called play workers who kind of hang out in the playground with the kids, right? What's their role?
So as a play worker, you support children's play, and what we're doing is we're compensating children for the lack of adult-free play. A play worker's role is possibly the most difficult, but definitely the most rewarding. As a play worker, you're constantly attuned to everything that's happening. So all your senses are alert and you're risk assessing what they're doing, what the weather's like. So yeah, that's part of the process.
Could you give me an example of like a recent moment when you felt like, okay, now maybe I need to step in, or where you decided not to step in for a given reason?
A little girl that I've worked with for quite a while, we've got metal containers and the children jump off them onto mattresses. It's about 8 foot off the ground, so she's tiny in comparison. So the children make their way up and they climb up wooden pallets to get to the top. And I seen her for days, you know, trying so hard to jump off, and she just couldn't do it. And there was a bit of name calling, and, you know, she took a little bit of flack for not being able to do it. And I think at times like that, it's difficult to not go, you'll be absolutely fine, just jump. And after a few days, she did it. And I tried to hide my delight, although I screamed and she came running towards me and was so proud. And then since then, she's climbed back up and repeated it time and time again until eventually she was impersonating a bird. She was doing it backwards. She was doing flips off it. So, yeah, that was a time when I didn't intervene. And I was so glad because she came to realize that she could do this for herself. I even did it myself.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about. I mean, how do adults or parents react when they first see the land? It sounds so unlike other playgrounds that we're used to.
When selling the idea, many parents hold positive play memories. And I think you have to allow and encourage them to reminisce. It's vital. They start to remember what they used to get up to and hear some good stories off some of these parents. And, you know, at the end of the day, what they want for their children is to lead a healthy, happy life. You know, that's where you advocate for what you're doing.
This may sound like a very American question, but do you have parents sign waivers or something before their children come into play on the land? I mean, they're taking risks there.
Yeah, we have registration forms whereby parents fill it in with the child's name, age, any allergies. And on the bottom of it, it says that I allow my child to participate. They may get wet, messy, muddy. But that's not a disclaimer as such. It's more, this is what's going to happen to your child when they come to the land. They're going to get dirty. They're going to get muddy. So it's just letting them know.
So was there a particular moment when you realized that kids in your community in particular needed this kind of free space, whether it's the land or it's the play priority areas?
I felt children should be able to play every day, any time. You know, it shouldn't just be the holidays. I knew with the land that children can return day after day and they can continue with whatever they were playing if they choose.
So the land and other sites like it, they're called adventure playgrounds, and that they date back, I read, to the 1940s or something like that, when, of course, during and after the Second World War, bravery was kind of this social value. I don't know whether that's the case anymore, but what's the rationale behind letting kids do this kind of adventure play, this risky play?
I think children get socialized in every other corner of their lives. You know, they're told what to do, how to behave. They go to school, they go to clubs, they do different structured activities. And I think sometimes that their playful behavior is interrupted or repressed. And they sit behind or inside this protective shield. So
with parental oversight all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And you know, children need to experience risk to ever be able to overcome it and manage it for themselves.
Do you ever have kids get hurt, get scrapes or bruises or things like that?
Yeah.
And then see them come back? I mean, do they come back to the land in a different kind of way?
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, minor accidents are inevitable, especially when a child starts coming for the first time, because they need to calibrate to the environment. They need to figure out that, oh, actually, if I run down that bank, I'm going to fall. And only a few weeks ago, a little girl came onto the playground and she used a bunch of nettles to climb up the bank.
So
obviously, it stung her hand, and it wasn't the end of the world. But she learned from that I won't use them to climb up again.
What do you think kids are losing if their play is limited to kind of safe backyards and rubberized playgrounds?
I think risk is an important part of growing up and an important developmental process for children. And I think they get a sense of personal achievement when they figure out things for themselves, when there's not an adult there telling them how to do something or to do something in a certain way. They get this sense of personal achievement and this increased confidence and self-esteem, as well as, you know, experiencing pleasure and enjoyment.
How did you play as a kid?
Kind of, kind of the same. I think I did everything these kids are doing. I played on the land, where the land is now, because I'm from that estate. So I see, you know, that kids are naturally attracted to such a space. And, you know, they still are.
It sounds like fun to me to be a person who stands on the playground and watches kids play and kind of stays out of their way. But it sounds like it would just make my days better. Does it make your days better?
Oh, absolutely. I love it so much. And I think as a play worker, you're not always comfortable. You know, you may feel uneasy if you think rough and tumble is going to turn into real fighting, or if children do have a real fight. You may hate swearing or spitting, for example. But I think what you have to hold on to the fact that our job is to compensate children for the lack of adult-free play. So it's really important that you suspend any of that prejudice and judgment and trust the children that you're serving. So.
Has it made your days more playful?
Yeah, definitely.
Claire Griffiths manages The Land. It's an adventure playground in Wrexham, Wales.
You know, I traveled the world for 30 years for the Wall Street Journal, writing my books, the New York Times, finding left behind people. You know, in Pakistan and Afghanistan and blighted urban cores of America. And at some point we realized the most dramatically left behind person that I had ever met, based on the neurological hand he'd been dealt, was living in the bedroom.
That's Ron Suskind talking about his son, Owen. Just before Owen turned 3, he was diagnosed with a rare form of autism. Steve Paulson asked Suskind when he saw the first signs that Owen was changing.
We had moved to Washington in the fall of 1993. I was moving down to be the senior national affairs writer for the Wall Street Journal, and it was my wife and I, our 2 children. We have an older son, Walter, who's 2.5 years older than Owen. He was 5. Owen was just 2.5 at that point, our little guy. And he was chatting away at 2.5. I love you, let's get ice cream, the normal 2.5-year-old speech. And then he started to lose speech rather dramatically and quickly. In about 2 months, he was down to one word, juice, one word, and was quite inconsolable. He was crying a lot. He was not sleeping. He couldn't make eye contact. And at that point, we were terrified, and we sought out specialists.
Wow. And Owen was eventually diagnosed with regressive autism. What do we know about this disorder?
Well, regressive autism is very much like traditional, let's say, autism. It's genetically coded. There may be some environmental trigger, just like lots of autism. We don't know really the cause so much. But it comes later. So the kids seem typical often in the first year or two. And then somewhere between usually 18 and 36 months, they regress, as it says. And that's startling for the parents, just like it was for us. You have videos of them at 2, and they're smiling and they're laughing, and then they're not. And those videos are ones we eventually couldn't watch.
Do you remember that first day that you got the diagnosis of regressive autism?
Oh, sure. 20 years ago now, but it feels like it was last Tuesday. You can remember it that vividly. The people who, sitting in that chair, as the doctor says, autism, they froze in place, and you start to float above them. And then they explain, look, he may never get his speech back. Many of them don't. You need to think about supporting him for the next 50 years and 30 years after you're dead, probably. And your life will now be different.
Yeah. Now, a big part of this story with Owen is the fascination he developed for Disney films, which has proved to be life-changing. But when you first saw this, when you saw how much he loved watching Disney films, were you kind of worried?
Well, sure. You know, I mean, he liked them like other kids did before the onset of the autism. And his big brother, Walt, 2.5 years older, they all watched them. They watched them a lot. But there was a change after the autism because he was watching them with a kind of intensity. Now, remember, he's not speaking at this point. And so we wondered. We asked our doctors, is this all right? And they said, well, is he joyful? We said, he seems to be. Well, he's not comfortable almost anywhere else, so it's all right. Don't stop it. And then we start to see he's looking at them with enormous intensity. And then we start to realize something may be going on here.
When did he talk again? When was the next time?
Well, the first moment where we are startled is over the months as he has stopped speaking and when he's 4 years old. You know, he's murmuring some gibberish. You know, he's saying, Juicervos, Juicervos. And we're watching a movie that he was clearly into at this point, watching it silently, his eyes alight, called The Little Mermaid. And we're all up in the bedroom because this is really the only family activity we can do together. And this part where Ariel, the protagonist, has to trade her voice to become human. And, of course, the sea witch, the villain, says, it won't cost you much, just a trifle, really, just your voice. And Cornelia, we thought he'd been saying, I want more juice. And she was giving him juice, Juicervos. She says, it's not juice, it's just. And all of a sudden we see it on the screen, just your voice. And I grab him and I say, oh my God, just your voice. And he's saying, Juicervos, Juicervos, Juicervos. And this is a moment. Walter's brother starts jumping on the bed. Owen's talking again. This is what we called our Annie Sullivan, Helen Keller moment. Now, of course, the doctors brought us in and sat us down again. You know, this is an education process. And they said, look, this may seem miraculous, but this is called echolalia. The kids who lose speech, like Owen, often develop this, just like what it sounds, echo. They echo noise. I said, so he doesn't know what the words mean. They said, probably not, because the processing, auditory processing, the way you process speech in your brain goes haywire often for autistic kids when this happens. So we were brought down to earth again, bucket of cold water. This goes on for some years, where he seems to be verbalizing noises and scripts from the movies, little bits of a few words or a bit of dialogue.
And then something else happened, wasn't it, on Walter's ninth birthday, his brother's ninth birthday.
Absolutely.
And Owen talked again.
Yeah, exactly. And his brother, of course, is a traditional sibling of a disabled kid. He's wildly independent, a junior adult at a very young age. And so we don't much notice that Walter gets emotional on only one day of the year, his birthday. And after this happens on his ninth birthday, Owen, who's saying virtually nothing at this point, a few words, follows us into the kitchen, looks at us intently, and says, Walter doesn't want to grow up like Mowgli or Peter Pan.
Wow.
Now, this is like a thunderbolt went through the kitchen. Owen is 6 and a half at this point. You know, he's barely said much, you know, three-word sentences, I want you to give me the ball. And now he's offered a complex sentence of a very complex and nuanced thought. Now, at this moment, you know, he runs off in his private reverie, Owen, whatever he's thinking. And Cornelia and I don't stop talking for 4 hours. You know, how do we get back in? You know, it's like a window opened and we could see him again. And so that night, I go up to his bedroom and I grab one of his puppets. He seemed very intent on a movie called Aladdin. The villain is Jafar, the evil vizier of Agrabah. His villainous sidekick is Iago, the parrot. Well, the parrot puppet is sitting on the floor of Owen's bedroom. I put it on. I crawl up to the edge of the bed. Owen's looking at a book, oblivious to me. And I push the puppet up through the edge of the bedspread. And I talk to him in the voice of Iago. And so I say, Owen, how does it feel to be you? And he turns to the puppet like he's bumping into an old friend. And he says, not good. I have no friends and I'm lonely. And this is our first conversation. And we talk, Owen and Iago, the evil puppet. And then after a few minutes, I hear Owen seeming to clear his throat, and he answers back, I love the way your foul little mind works. And that would be Jafar, the villain. And that's the way things went then. A conversation begins between a villain and his evil sidekick. Now, at that point, the Susskind family, the household, turns upside down. Cornelia and I realize he must have memorized all of these scripts and the dialogue and the lyrics, mostly is sound. And if you throw him a line, he'll throw you back the next line.
But the thing is, clearly, I mean, it wasn't just this sort of repeating words. I mean, there was meaning here.
Well, that was our question. How much does he understand? Well, over time, we realized that he was understanding more and more. Because we would play out the scenes, and it wasn't just mimicry. He seemed to be channeling the emotions of the characters. And so this begins what we called the basement sessions in our house, where we played out scenes from all the Disney movies, about 20 of them that were clearly Owen's special favorites. And everyone joined in, his older brother, Cornelia, me, and we became Disney characters. So here we were living a traditional Washington life. Cornelia's driving Owen to every therapy session she can find. Walter's going to school. I'm going to the Wall Street Journal Bureau every day. But at night, we become animated characters. Over years, this is how he gets his speech back, little by little.
I mean, so this is what you did for years to play these characters.
Yeah.
Your whole family did.
Yeah, my whole family. Yeah. I mean, you know, of course, I lived a public life otherwise. I was writing books about presidents, interviewing them, wrestling with them in public on television shows. And then I led this other life. So one day I'd be talking about George Bush and Dick Cheney, and the next day I'd be in the basement meditating on evil with Owen about which villain was the most pernicious and evil. And we even at one point talked about Bush and Cheney, where Owen was trying to make connections. I said, don't go there, buddy. Don't go there.
Just to hear you just tell the story, I mean, it almost sends chills down my spine. I mean, it's like you're describing a kid who, you know, really couldn't talk, couldn't articulate, and then suddenly he comes out with these profound things.
You know what? Here's what we find. You know, Owen now is almost 23, just turned 23, and we know lots and lots of kids that we've met over the years with affinities that are quite deep. And when they're nourished, when they're encouraged, we find surprising things occur, that they are doing things not dissimilar to what Owen does. It's often not recognized because there's kind of no place for it in either therapy or education. But, you know, they're creating a language. Some kids speak map. Some kids speak train schedule. Some kids speak anime. But they're using it to find their way in the world. And this is the great lesson that Owen teaches us. Owen's older brother, Walter, says it best. He says, "Owen is my best teacher." And in some ways, that's part of what happened. We worldwise folks, like me and my wife, you know, I've taught at famous colleges and all of that mumbo jumbo. Owen has been our teacher. A kid, mind you, with a measurable IQ of 75. And to put IQ scores on these kids, there should be a law against that. But he's got that tattoo to his arm, like many kids do, because they are so untraditional in how they express their essence, their ability, that they get discarded. And for Owen, that means here's a mop, mop till you die and be happy. We're actually finding a powerful counterpoint to that. And now specialists are joining us. Leading autism researchers are saying, you know, these affinities are actually more pathway, we think, than prison.
So you're saying that that Owen's story has actually changed the way people, the so-called experts, think about autism and what to do about it?
I sit here surprised to report this. I am an investigative reporter. I am skeptical of everything. But that, in fact, is the case.
I would think the big question would be whether Owen could sort of move from this role-playing fictional world dealing with these imaginary characters from Disney films, whether that translates to the real world and actually how he interacts with other people. Did that happen?
Well, you know, it's interesting because it's really happened just in the last 3 years. He left home 3 years ago to go to a college-like program on Cape Cod for folks with various challenges, many of them on the autism spectrum. And of course, the first thing he does when he gets there, he starts Disney Club because he needs friends. He's often been friendless, and now he says, "I need to find friends." And it's very heartening because they have found a community of shared purpose and shared affinity. And from there, relationships are growing quickly.
So when you think about Owen's future now, are you worried, concerned, hopeful?
You know, we will always be concerned. He is autistic. He will always be autistic. This is not a spell that gets broken. It's a way of being. And the challenges keep coming. But, you know, I think we are more hopeful than we ever could have imagined, because what we're finding is that he has built a toolkit from his own special affinity and, of course, from the love and support of the family and his friends and the therapists, where he's able to sort of make his way, at least more and more without us. Someday it will be without us. And we can see a time where that will work out okay. And he has his brother, who recently in an interview said, "Look, I can see someday I'll be 70 and Owen will be 68 and he'll live near me. You know, I'll check up on him and see him all the time." And at that point, Walter's confident they'll be talking about a lot more than just Disney. They're already doing some of that.
Ron Suskind's book about Owen and Disney is called Life Animated, a story of sidekicks, heroes, and autism. You'll find a longer version of Steve's conversation with him on our website. That's ttbook.org. And sorry to say, that's all the time we have for play today. When we come back, a dangerous idea, and we'll talk about the insurgency sweeping Iraq. This is To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
To the Best of Our Knowledge proudly presents
Dangerous Ideas.
My name is Josh Ruxin, and my dangerous idea is that international aid is not nearly as good at poverty reduction in the long term as investing in business. As an academic who's actually worked on international aid one way or another for a couple of decades, this is a little bit heretical to even suggest. But I learned 7 years ago when my wife opened up a small business named Heaven Restaurant in Kigali, Rwanda, that the need for jobs and the need for vocational training is not being met by traditional aid, and that the impact that can be had by making that type of investment is enormous. So Alyssa and I, actually, at the time, we weren't rich trust fund kids by any stretch. We had an apartment. We took out a second mortgage. And then when that wasn't enough to build the restaurant, we actually ended up borrowing from friends and family. And when that wasn't enough, we took on credit card debt. And then we opened the doors to Heaven. And actually seeing the job creation that came from Heaven, where we've got a couple dozen full-time employees, and we work with farmers, and we work with artists, and we work with musicians and performers who come out onto the glorious deck at Heaven in order to work for tourists, work for locals, and create sources of finance that actually help to feed their families, to pay for health insurance, to pay for all the necessities. That is real poverty reduction. So my dangerous idea is let's figure out a way to take some portion of all the funding that goes into aid and invest in entrepreneurs, locals, but also international entrepreneurs. There's no reason why we shouldn't invest in American entrepreneurs who want to go to places like Rwanda or Kenya or Uganda and set up shop and build businesses that create jobs. What's dangerous is that it overturns the conventional wisdom. The conventional wisdom continues to be that if at a macro level we provide funding directly to governments or to non-governmental organizations and agencies, that that's ultimately going to be the way to defeat poverty. I think that that might reduce mortality rates. I think it might get rid of a lot of bad poverty and abject poverty. But in terms of ultimately defeating poverty, everyone, whether they're living in Ethiopia or in California, needs a job that pays a good wage, hopefully high enough to be able to afford insurance and to afford education and all the good things in life.
That's Josh Ruxin's dangerous idea. What's yours? Let us know on Facebook or Twitter. The handle's TTBook1. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week, we're thinking about ISIS, the Sunni militant group that's gaining ground in the Middle East. In the past month alone, ISIS fighters have swept through towns and cities in the north and west of Iraq, and that's threatening the stability of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's government. American troops left Iraq at the end of 2011, but now a few hundred American military advisors are going back to the country to support Iraqi forces. What does it all mean? Producer Raymond Tungekar turned to David Rode for some context. Rode's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of the book Beyond War, Reimagining America's Role and Ambitions in a New Middle East.
So it should be said, ISIS is a Sunni group, and the lands they've pretty much taken so far have been Sunni-dominated. What happens when they try to take over Shiite territories?
As they push down towards Baghdad and into Shiite areas in Iraq, they could face more resistance from the Iraqi army. It sounds from all reports I've read that the Iraqi army just collapsed and didn't really fight and allowed them to take Mosul, the country's second largest city. The danger here, and one of the basic tactics of ISIS, is to provoke a sectarian war, that they are killing every Shia they find. They want to provoke a response from Shia militias in Iraq. They want Iran to come in and back those Shia militias in Iraq and create a broader sectarian war. Part of their strategy and part of their belief is that if they can start a war between Sunnis and Shias, it will lead the Sunni population to rally to their side and join ISIS's cause.
Are we past the point now where sectarian divisions can be healed in Iraq?
We may be, and it's a long history. I'm looking into it now with my colleagues at Reuters, looking at sort of the U.S.'s relationship with Nouri al-Maliki. In 2007, he started setting up separate commands that were basically going around the mixed military that the U.S. had created in Iraq, and it was a mixed military with Sunni and Shias. And he started setting up military commands and then commando units that were basically dominated by Shia that were loyal to him. He's carried out a systematic campaign to sort of eviscerate his main Sunni political opponents and has jailed people, used force against Sunni demonstrators. And so he has created this rift and exacerbated this rift that exists in Iraq. At the same time, Sunnis ruled, you know, the Sunni minority ruled Iraq for decades under Saddam Hussein. And, you know, Maliki doesn't really have a partner on the Sunni side. The Sunnis haven't accepted the idea that the Shia majority in Iraq should run the country. So none of these problems are resolved. Multiple diplomats that we've talked to said during the surge, when there were, you know, 100,000, 70,000 U.S. troops, there was still this sectarian divide. And that core issue, you know, remains unresolved.
Would a change in leadership pacify the country?
So the main Obama administration strategy is to replace Maliki, that someone will step forward who's willing to share power. Probably, you know, it would have to be a Shia since they're the majority in the country, but someone who would be willing to name, let's say, a Sunni defense minister and a Sunni interior minister and maybe release some of the Sunni political leaders that have been jailed by Maliki. That person hasn't emerged yet. And, you know, John Kerry went to Baghdad this week, but he didn't emerge with some magical deal. And we've talked to multiple former ambassadors, and they think, you know, Maliki's going to dig in. And Maliki's done this in the past. In 2010, you know, he came in second in the elections for prime minister, and he refused to give up power and managed to hold on after, you know, a process that took 8 months, 8 to 10 months to name a new government. Does Iraq have 8 to 10 months now to wait as, you know, horse trading goes on and Maliki either survives or another leader is chosen? I don't think Iraq has that much time.
Given the urgency of the situation, aside from replacing al-Maliki, is there anything else that the U.S. can do to help in the region?
This is the dilemma. If, you know, the administration is right that the long-term answer is a new government that's more inclusive, where you could essentially turn the Sunni tribes that are now cooperating with ISIS and that allowed them to take these areas in western Iraq. These are the same tribes that rose up against al-Qaeda in the surge in 2007. If you can get those Sunni tribes to join the government and turn on ISIS, you could make real military headway against ISIS. But that's not happening so far. And the only other alternative, as far as I can tell, is U.S. military force. Bombing alone, you know, isn't going to stop or remove ISIS. It's somehow getting these Sunnis to come back to the government. It's a very dangerous and difficult situation, and I don't think the answer is sending in U.S. troops either. And it's a stalemate, and there's a very good chance we are going to see Iraq break into three parts in the months ahead.
So what I find surprising about all of this are just the numbers. I think ISIS's army is estimated at just about 7,000, whereas the Iraqi army is over 200,000 strong. How is that even possible, where such a small group could pose such a grave threat to a nation?
The key thing that's happened with ISIS is that the Sunni population, and again, these Sunni tribes that were key in the uprising and the surge in 2007, are now supporting ISIS. In the past, the militants that ruled Iraq in 2007 were so brutal that the Sunni population turned against them. So that's where the key is, getting these Sunni moderates who don't, I think, adhere to ISIS's vision of a caliphate and its harsh interpretation of Islam, somehow getting them to turn on ISIS is the key here. It's not going to be American troops or Shias that can drive them out of western Iraq. In my book, I write a lot about moderates and how important it is to track them, support them where possible, and include them in governments. And that's not what's happened in Iraq. Again, Maliki has sort of created a Shia-dominated police state.
Well, could you talk about some of those ways? How do you engage these Sunni moderates?
Well, one basic thing, and you know what hasn't happened in Iraq, is to include them in the more in government structures, not to sort of hunt them down and jail them, as has occurred there. And a key thing as well is trying to create more economic growth and not to isolate them, to not play into these jihadi conspiracy theories that there's a Shia plot to, you know, eliminate Sunni Islam, you know, or that there's a American or Christian or, you know, Hindu or Jewish plot to eliminate Islam. It's going to take a long time. It's going to be a difficult process. Every faith has had very difficult periods where there's a lot of violence. But I'm just convinced that in the end, you know, jihadism will be seen as this sort of very backward and brutal form of rule that most people will not want to live under in the region.
You know, I wonder, decades from now, how do you think U.S. efforts in Iraq and in the larger Middle East, how do you think that'll be viewed?
Well, you know, one of the critiques and one of the things you hear from the people in the region is that the U.S. has backed dictators for decades in the region, and it was part of this policy to have stable oil prices. And when I talk to diplomats about the problem, they say that in terms of Iraq specifically, the current generation of leaders, they don't trust democracy. They never lived under democracy. They lived under Saddam Hussein. So Maliki, for instance, you know, I don't know, I've never met him, but in general, what you find with leaders in the region, and there are exceptions, and let me say that, but by and large in this region, leaders are not willing to compromise with their rivals politically. They're not willing to share power because they fear there won't be another election, that they won't have a chance to regain power if they lose this round. And essentially, when you get power, you amass as much of it as you can for your group or your sect, because you have to be strong, otherwise it's weakness. So this leads to the situation today where there was an effort to introduce democracy in Iraq. The leaders, at least most of this current generation, aren't willing to share power, and it's a very dangerous and difficult situation. I don't have an easy answer, but people in the region say we've had a role in creating this dynamic as well.
David Rode is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with Reuters. His book is Beyond War, Reimagining America's Role and Ambitions in a New Middle East. You can find a deep archive of interviews about America's role in Iraq on our website. That's ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tungekar produced today's show with help from Doug Gordon and Charles Monroe Kane. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. Our regular host, Anne Strangechamps, is out on vacation. I'm Sarah Nix. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.